When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the most impressive monuments, hanging gardens, and superstructures were lauded, listed, and visited as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. Later Magnificent Sevens have included spectacular constructions such as Machu Picchu and the Taj Mahal, or awesome natural phenomena such as the Grand Canyon and the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the actor, comedian, radio and TV presenter Rufus Hound. In a wide-ranging career, Rufus was a regular team member in the early series of the raucous late-night TV panel show Celebrity Juice and has acted on stage at Stratford with the Royal Shakespeare Company. He has starred in several major West End musicals, a pantomime or two, and presents My Teenage Diary on Radio 4. And Rufus, you've also appeared in several reality TV shows, including one called Famous and Fearless. Would you say Famous and Fearless could be your motto?
Well, yes. When they offered it to me, I rather felt like, finally, my show. But Jonathan Ross made the joke that year at the Comedy Awards, which was Famous and Fearless, or as it should have been called, And.
Well, you've done other ones as well. I mean, you had a bit of a hiccup with whatever the ice skating, dancing on ice is called. I think COVID ruled you out at one stage, but that might have been a lucky break because you may have avoided breaking your ankles or whatever else happens to skaters in that.
Do you know, I tried to set up a bit of a joke on that show, which was that everybody who does anything like that is all over the papers and in interviews going, I've always loved ice dancing. Oh, you know. This is a lifelong dream. And I said to their press department, you know, that's just obviously a lie. So why don't I try a different approach? I'll go out and I'll say, I'm just doing this for the money. It's in the middle of a pandemic. It's the last thing I want to be doing. And then that gives us a bit of leeway. You know, we can tell a bit of a story about a man who comes to find a love of ice dancing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I watched the first VT when it played out and it was none of that. And then I was out after a week. So I basically got to spend 12 weeks with a lovely woman who taught me how to ice dance, which came to almost naff all use.
Well, I mean, these various things, I mean, some are more challenging than others, but they certainly take up a lot of time, don't they? I mean, Strictly Come Dancing, they spend weeks learning to dance. And if you eventually win or you're in the final, it looks great. But if you're eliminated halfway through, it's, you know, everybody's even forgotten you're on it. So
yes. Well, that's the thing. I remember a TV producer saying to me about a panel show once, the incredibly brilliant Dom English said to me after one show we'd worked on together, you know how you win this? And I said, no, how? And he said, you're funniest. He was bored of me trying to actually answer any of the questions.
Well, we've gone down this route of talking about these TV shows, but what I wanted to stress actually at the beginning, in case people aren't aware of it, is these stage performances you've done. And when you set off to be famous and fearless, did you have it in mind you wanted to be on the West End stage or the RSC playing Hamlet or in a big musical? Or did you think, oh, I could be on a panel and it just so happens you got some offers that came in later?
When I was about 3 and a half, I was obsessed with The Muppet Show. And I am completely convinced that at that young, impressionable age, something went in that was, the best this will ever get is if you can find another group of weirdos and all put on a show together.
Yes.
So, genuinely, I think I've... hang on, sorry. This isn't therapy, and I can't give you the therapy answer. I'm trying to find the funny answer.
Oh, well, don't worry about that. Make it not lowering the tone, but going off on a slightly different route, because you're called Rufus Hound. Now, my deep researches reveal you weren't born as Rufus Hound, and you've got some magnificent names, Robert James Blair Simpson. Mm. Any combination of those would be a great name for a West End actor. Of, you know, Blair Simpson, you could have been in the 1950s playing something, but Robert Blair, Robert Simpson, any of those would perhaps more fit being a West End stage performer than Rufus Hound. Or is Rufus Hound just nice and distinctive in any event?
When I started off, I didn't have the money to go to drama school or anything like that. So my dreams of being an actor had been absolutely in place from three onwards. If you asked me what I was going to do, I was going to be an actor in theatres. And I did every school play and, you know, spent my spare time in the drama block reading Willie Russell and Shakespeare and all of these things. Mm. It was always what I wanted to do. Got to 19, my family was completely skint, and the idea of going to drama school was anathema. And at that point, I realised, oh, these are the dreams of a child. And now I am a real man. I must put them aside and move on. However, within a few years of having had normal jobs, I realised that I was never going to last and that I better do something. And stand-up was something that you could go and do. I mean, in wanting to be an actor, I'd always wanted to be funny. And so stand-up was something you could ring and ask for 5 minutes on stage, which is not the case with, you know, the RSC.
Yes.
So it was that, really. When I started off doing it, I'd always loved comedy. Comedy had always been my passion, really. But I'd wanted to be a comedy actor and do that live. And then stand-up was the thing the opportunity to do stand-up overtook the opportunity to be an actor. And so I sat in a cafe with a group of friends, and we all said, what would be a good name for an actor? Sorry, not that. Yeah, we all sat in a cafe in Edinburgh and said, what would be a good name for a stand-up comedian who looked like this? And I had a bit longer hair and a shaggier beard, and they said, well, Rufus for the red and look a bit doggy, so Hound. But it was a toss-up between that and Jiminy Biscuit.
I've been around comedians for a long while. I always counsel against having silly names because you always find yourself wanting to get rid of them. I don't know if your memory goes back this far, but, you know, Julian Clary is a perfectly good name, but he used to perform under the name of Joan Collins Fan Club.
Yeah.
Jo Brown called herself the Sea Monster for a bit. There's a comedian you'll have known, Ian Cognito, another one called Mark My Words. These are all funny names, but they're all ones you might want to ditch, especially if you're going to be playing Hamlet at Stratford.
I think it's rather good when you see somebody with one of those terrible names because it shows you the scope of their limited ambition from their offset.
Well, Rufus, I'm not going to suggest that. That didn't apply to you because it was a stepping stone. The comedy was a stepping stone. But let's get going on your seven wonders. So the first of your seven wonders is the Natural History Museum. Now, why have you chosen that?
Well, I would like to be more clear than this. I haven't chosen the Natural History Museum. I have chosen the Natural History Museum outside only.
Outside only. Well, I did know it was outside only, but I'm puzzled from the off because that's all I know. Is it because you were never allowed to go inside the Natural History Museum when you were a kid, or that you did go in and found the cases full of stuffed animals not to your liking, or are you just an architectural enthusiast?
Well, this is the thing. It's the outside only, Clive, because I used to work at the Science Museum.
Right.
And we were endlessly having problems with DCMS not giving us the correct amount of funding, whilst also insisting that we remain free and do ever more and ever more.
Yeah.
So working there, it was very hard. It also began my absolute hate affair with Jeremy Hunt, who was the DCMS minister at that time, who then went on to run the NHS and, you know, is now ferreting around doing whatever he's doing.
Yeah, that's the Department of Culture, Media and Sport.
That's right. In charge of funding our national museums.
Now, I don't know who's going to be listening to this podcast. Perhaps people all around the world, certainly all around the country. So the Science Museum is next door to the Natural History Museum.
That's right.
Then over the road is the Victoria and Albert Museum. It's a whole area of London with those museums. So it used to be called, I think, Albertopolis, because it was built with the money that Prince Albert was kind of responsible for the Great Exhibition, or he was the titular head of that. So it is a wonderful place. This is when you were working there as an adult, though. Did you go there as a child? Did you visit those museums?
Yeah, we definitely did a school trip there at one point and, you know, absolutely overwhelmed and loved it to pieces. But really, the reason it's outside only is because our visitor numbers would have a big part to play in what everyone got paid.
Yes.
So if I come on this podcast and start promoting the Natural History Museum, I feel incredibly disloyal. because the actual contents of the Science Museum are 10 times better than what's in the Natural History Museum. A million times better.
Well, wait a minute. Why don't you make your first wonder the Science Museum rather than the outside of the Natural History Museum?
Because in terms of sheer wonder, what I've done when trying to give you seven options is think of things that inspire me with genuine wonder.
Yeah.
And because I worked at the Science Museum in my younger years, and in my prime drinking years, Clive, I mean, I ran almost exclusively on ethanol.
Yes.
Was that quite often I'd be staggering back along around that corner, and it struck me one night that in terms of architecture at the time that thing was being built, everybody's model was kind of cathedral-y.
Yes.
And the night that I realised they basically built a cathedral in order to put all of the evidence that there was no God, I just loved it so much. There is something so brilliant about such a religious-looking building holding all of the evidence that we evolved. That yes. I found it... That's what I find wondrous, is not only is it beautiful architecturally, it also sort of stands oxymoronically. And at the same time, demands that you take everything inside it seriously. And I think that seems sort of classically British and wonderful.
Yeah, and of course it does have, if you look closely, they're sort of tiles really on the outside, but they have got pictures or representations of animals and plants hinting at what's going to be inside the building.
And there's gargoyles and, you know, they're all animal-y and, yeah, it's, I mean, absolutely glorious and gorgeous. And, you know, in the winter, because they've got all that bit out the front that looks so beautiful, they're allowed to have an ice rink. Can the Science Museum have an ice rink, Clive? No, the Science Museum cannot have an ice rink.
I know you're a man of passion, but I don't think the fact that you worked at the Science Museum needs to inform everything you how you react to.
Couldn't be more wrong, Clark. Once you cut me, I will not stop bleeding. And those guys have got it way too easy. This is beef. This goes way, way back. We were doing shows and blowing things up. And, you know, at one point I offered to be shot by someone to prove a thing about material science. That's how much I was a true believer.
Oh, wow.
But their numbers are always higher because they've got a dinosaur in a pretty building. Oh, naff off.
Well, I lived in London, so we used to quite often go on a trip to see the museums. And having got there, there's a long sort of tunnel you come from the underground station, which is great. And we certainly went to the Science Museum, but I'd say we always end up in the Natural History Museum in the end. But so you don't want to say any more about the design of the outside of the Natural History Museum, the decorations, what it's supposed to represent. It's just a lovely building as far as you're concerned.
Well, I think it's more than just a lovely building. Yes, that's fair, I suppose. There are lots of buildings that I think people want me to be wowed by, but I just think my brain isn't wired up to see those as much more than follies.
Yes.
You know, once you've been to sort of Greece or, you know, South America and seen these things at 1,000 years old, you think, when people were building them, they thought, this will stand forever. And really, it just sort of stands as a testimony to hubris. But I think what I like about it is all the ideas that play around in my head. Like the idea that they built a religious building to house the things that can show you that we evolved. I really enjoy that. I think I also like at the time that was being built, when you look around the country, buildings that were being built at the same time were often being built for far more nefarious reasons and funded by far more nefarious industries. And I like the fact that if you look at the Natural History Museum, there is at least a sense in which knowledge and wisdom and fact have been revered enough in this country to be genuinely supported.
Sure. And of course, buildings generally, that was kind of Britain's century, you know, 19th century. That's where the wealth was. So you have, St Pancras Station in London, Natural History Museum, your town halls up and down the country, municipal pride representing either Gothic or Romanesque buildings, which look older than they really are.
Yeah.
They look as it's the point you're making, I suppose.
It's like Tower Bridge is only from about 1984, isn't it?
Well, even the law courts in the Strand, they look like a sort of medieval construction, but they're equally just a 19th century building, but they're all showing off, I suppose, the wealth that was available and looking forwards as well, and as knowledge opening up, as you say.
I think it's also that there was a point in the world's history where we were, you know, the big I am. And the fact that we used some of that for things like public education makes me feel, you know, rather proud.
Yes.
It's possibly compounded by the fact that it's hard to feel that we're going in the same direction currently.
Well, I don't know. There's, of course, in other museums, like the British Museum, there's this controversy about some of the exhibits, that they should be returned to where they started. I don't know if the same applies to stuffed animals, but I suppose it might do in the end. Because not to the dinosaur, but it may be the sea wants its whale back.
Do you think that's, you know, if we see a tsunami on the Kent coast, we'll all think, oh, God, you know, global warming's finally tipped us over. But instead, it's just Neptune asking for its bones back.
Who or what is your next wonder of the world?
Well, I was recently on Mastermind, and my special subject was Jim Henson.
Yes.
And he would certainly be a character who I would think was wonderful.
Well, you've already hinted at his role in your life, and I suppose an awful lot of people, you were young when you saw it, but an awful lot of people even older than you, looking at the Muppets and its various guises that Jim Henson created, was a huge success and remains. Everybody, I think, has a warm feeling about, you either just ignore them or you love them, really. There's nobody I would have thought would dislike the Muppets.
Yeah, is there a sense of take it or leave it with people? I don't know, really. All I know is that they have been as much a part of how I've understood the world as, you know, some of my own family. I think the mania, the nonsense, the fact that the jokes were so always deliberately bad, and that's, I think, what I've also learned a lot about theatrical comedy and performing comedy.
Oh, I thought that, yes, that informed your comedy, did it?
Yes, very much so. Well, it at least informed my understanding that more often than not, it's less the quality of the joke than the quality of the delivery.
Yeah.
And the sincerity as well. But I suppose when you're a kid, you watch that thing because it's funny jokes and funny songs and whatnot. Mm. And that, in combination with the work that Jim Henson did on Sesame Street, those two in parallel, I think probably had just an unbelievable guiding force on my own sense of, in inverted commas, what normal is.
And of course, lots of characters in the Muppet Show that he created. Would you have a favourite? Are you a Kermit man, a Miss Piggy? Those grumpy ones, the critics
Waldorf and Statler.
Yeah, how about them? You go for them, or are they hate figures for, you know?
I think everyone has their favourites. I'm a big fan of Gonzo on the whole, even amongst all those weirdos, he's the weirdo.
Sure. So you're a drummer? Would you do that?
Well, that was Animal. Animal was the drummer in the band.
Oh, yeah. There's Ralph the dog.
Pianist.
Yes.
Who was the first sort of Muppet that Jim Henson regularly performed with and was well known to people before he was on The Muppet Show.
Yeah.
Kind of an everyman figure, Rolf, really. He's not as mad as the rest of them, but there's something about that slouched demeanour at the piano. You kind of feel like this dog's got a few years on him, you know?
Yeah. And what about Kermit? Because I've mentioned that in addition to acting and being a panellist and doing this and that, you do present programmes. So,
yeah.
And Kermit is the sort of the ultimate presenter figure, isn't he?
Well, I would honestly say, you know, really, that if I ever could claim that I was really great at one thing, it was probably comparing. I won one prize in my comedy career, and it was as best compare.
Well done.
Yeah, I mean, look, is that the same as being, you know, Michael McIntyre or Bo Burnham? No, not really. But I think for who I really am deep down, the ability to stand on stage and start talking to people and make that funny always felt like the joy, because it's a live thing. You know, I haven't just come out here and delivered my 20 minutes verbatim. I'm actually making this moment funny.
Yes.
So that always felt like joy, and knowing the rhythm and the pattern and how to tie it all together and improv through that. I did always really enjoy that part of it. But then, you know, you're essentially limited to earn about 30 grand a year if you do that job. And don't get me wrong, 30 grand a year, how lovely. But, you know, with a wife and two children trying to live in London, it wasn't really a goer. So you have to park that. But, Yeah, I've got a lot of respect for Kermit being the one kind of keep looking off into the wings, making sure the next act's ready and padding if they're not.
Well, if you think about somebody like Bruce Forsyth, he was essentially a compare of programmes, and he was a compare beyond compare.
Beyond compare, yeah.
But he, oddly enough, was slightly frustrated because he could dance, he could sing, he was a comedian. He wanted to be Sammy Davis Jr. He didn't want to be the host of, you know, Play Your Cards Right. But he just happened to be very, very good at that. And I think he did all right in financial terms. I'm only guessing. But
yeah, impossible to know, isn't it? I think I filmed his last ever TV show.
Oh, right. I hope you weren't too rough on him and caused his demise.
No, I don't believe so, although I'd have to check the tape.
Yeah.
I don't think it was the last thing he recorded. I think it was the last thing it was broadcast of his.
All right. What was that, a game show? Or?
It was a Strictly Come Dancing Christmas special.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But I remember I'd met him years before and found him slightly grumpy, you know, fair enough. Why wouldn't you be? A certainly older man who, you know, is getting on with things and whatnot. And I knew a few people who'd worked with him who'd said, you know, he's Bruce. You just got to kind of, you know, factor that in. So I'd always been a little bit like, oh, I'll give him a bit of room. Mm. You know, I don't need to be another person coming up to go, oh, Bruce, how nice to meet you. Anyway, got through to the end of it. And he really shook my hand and he really looked me in the eyes and he went, well done, you've done ever so well there. And it was like looking into the eyes of like a forebear. Like, you know, if you look at a chimpanzee or an orangutan, sometimes you think, oh, yeah, these are the ones that went before me. These are, you know, there's something really like historic about it. And that was exactly how I felt shaking Bruce's hand, looking into his eyes, was like, oh, You're like a point in time. You're a fixed position. You're a frame of reference. It was quite something.
Now, this isn't really a program for my stories, but I interviewed him once. I was sitting in for Terry Wogan, and it happened to be a snowy night. So there was only about 10 people in the audience, all of whom were only there because they really wanted to see Terry Wogan, and they weren't. And Bruce Forsyth was my first guest. And I thought, oh, that's good. He's a good guest. Well, I thought, well, this is going to be interesting because Sean Connery was my next guest. So these are, you know, the big stars. But two very...
You had two guests and the first was Bruce over Sean Connery.
Yes. So but I thought, this is fantastic. And I put them together. This is going to be memorable because, bring these two icons from two different wings of show business. Because when Sean came on, he said, oh, hello, Bruce. Now, that round we played yesterday at Tunbridge was so bad. We couldn't... Oh, no, I remember. Yes, I remember. Of course, 2 years ago when you came out to the Caribbean with me, you were not on form at all. So I was left out of it. They did not need me there. So it made for a good show, but didn't do me any good. All right, now before we leave Jim Henson, because you just mentioned it swiftly, he was your specialist subject on Mastermind, and I don't know if we should give away how well you did.
It's been broadcast.
It's been broadcast, but sometimes people can't. Anyway, you must have been pleased that you triumphed with not just with Jim Henson, but obviously with the general knowledge. There was somebody else, I won't name people necessarily, but somebody who had surprisingly poor general knowledge who you beat.
Please said.
Yeah. So you must have thought perhaps you weren't going to win, or you might not be winning as you were coming to the end of the programme, but you triumphed. You're a competitive person like that?
I went for between 8 and 13. I went to an all boys school where essentially everything we were taught was where do you rank, where do you stand. You know, I had competition beaten into me, and then I had 10 years of being married to a woman who tried to beat that out of me. Mm. And so now I try and both enjoy the spirit of the competition without taking it too seriously. But I'd be lying if I said that as somebody who I basically see in the world as clown shoes myself. Yes. Triumphs over somebody who I think is asking them to take them very seriously and, you know, that I know things.
Yeah.
There is a little, it's not so much a personal victory as I like to think that, you know, the monkeys won over the zookeepers kind of thing, you know.
Because you might have just thought, well, as you were mentioning before, you might have just thought, well, I'd better make sure I'm funny where it's possible and concentrate on that and not be so worried about getting every question right as quickly as possible. But I think you combined the two pretty well.
I do love a quiz. I mean, that is true. So I thought I would enjoy it anyway. But Yes. It was the outcome was pleasing for a number of reasons, but mainly the spirit of the game.
And you did it for a charity, and your charity was
the Refugee Council.
Yeah.
Which feels now, of course, incredibly political. And yes. Yet I was raised at a time where the idea that people who through no fault of their own had to flee from their home and that they could come to this country was like one of the kind of cornerstones of what we prided ourselves on. But, you know, yeah. Now I can happily receive a couple of million tweets from people telling me what an absolute scumbag that makes me.
You do run into a few problems every now and then. You shoot yourself in the foot with a dodgy tweet here and a remark there. Do you think there's something about you that sort of spins off?
Well, Clive, you know, my fear is that having done some therapy recently, I then turn to you and expect you to help me. But yeah, I am. Basically, I recently got diagnosed with ADHD, and part of that means there's a bit of emotional dysregulation. So I feel quite strongly when people are, you know, demonstrably doing something crap, that it should be that we're allowed to go, "Oi, no!" And when people are being really horrible, I do feel like a personal obligation to wade in and get stuck in. And so, you know, I have done stupid shit like defend Jimmy Carr in the middle of his tax scandal. Not because I was saying he'd done the right thing, but merely I was saying, you know, why is it that we will drag out a comedian for doing this, but there are these corporations that we're all paying money to that nobody has a problem with at all?
Welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science, in a good way. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Not the kind of doctor who'd be able to help much if you were having like a heart attack. But if you're wondering about quantum physics or the theory of matter, he's your man.
Well, probably.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Every week, we're asking a new, puzzling question from the world of science and discovering the answer with the help of a world-leading expert.
Like, will we ever talk to animals?
They are definitely talking. You know, that's, again, a word that I would qualify because we usually mean that vocally. But in their own ways, they're talking to us every single day.
Are face transplants the future of cosmetic surgery?
Given that range of what's considered attractive, there's probably no point wanting to change your face to be more attractive if you follow science. And should we fear an alien invasion?
If an imperialistic drive brings other civilizations to us, then obviously it's not good news. But if it's scientific exploration, it may be good news.
If you're interested in learning a little bit more about the weird, magnificent world around us, then this is the show for you. Eureka. Subscribe now and find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. New episodes every Wednesday.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Let's go on to your third wonder, if we may. What's your third wonder, Rufus?
My third wonder is the tale of Phineas Gage, who was an American railway construction worker who, as a result of an accident involving explosives, had a railway spike blasted through his head.
Yes.
Now, normally when these sorts of things happen, I think the gentlemanly thing to do, the right thing to do, is just to die. But Phineas didn't. He survived with a whole railway spike through his head. And what was fascinating is, even though he was still able to function, his personality completely changed. And that was the beginning of people understanding that the brain may have localization and different areas in it that were in charge of different things. So that one accident led us, you can say maybe these things are inevitable, but that one accident was the thing that led us to understanding the brain in a vastly more superior way. And I love the idea that, you know, we all understand that there is nothing that more complicated that we could try and comprehend than the human brain. And that one of the things that massively opened the door to that was literally just a bloke with a spike through his head.
So it's a silver lining to quite a dark cloud as far as he was concerned. So that if the doctor was talking to him and said, well, the good news is you haven't died. The bad news, you've knocked out half your brain. It's going to alter your personality and give you grief for the rest of your life. But the good news is that in doing that, humanity has discovered more about the brain without us having to force our way into somebody's brain. This has accidentally knocked out some bits of it, so we know more about it now.
Yeah, it was, you know, the fact that his personality changed so much had like really genuine implications for what people, you know, like phrenology had been an established and respectable science up until that point. So yeah, it's, I suppose the thing I like about it most is that if you explode a railway, you know, if you have a massive explosion, you kind of think that the only thing that comes out of that is destruction. But actually, it opened the door to our better understanding of, neuroplasticity and neurology across the board.
I suppose even before that, you know, the mere fact that he survived makes him a wonder. In somebody's eyes, and in your eyes, evidently that's the case. How did you know about him? Did he just stumble across this as an interesting fact, or have you played Phineas Gage in one of your many ventures?
It was again when we were working at the Science Museum. It was I got told that story, and it always just made me howl laughing. Because the other side of it was he was quite a mild-mannered bloke previously, and then the spike went through and everybody went, oh, he's got ever so cross. And I thought, well, so would you be if you had a railway spike through your head.
For the little I understand about it, it's not absolutely clear what the knocking out of this bit of his brain actually demonstrated. Some people looked at him one way and others looked at in the opposite way. It didn't, you know, make a complete revelation of how the brain worked.
And that's why I'm being deliberately vague in claiming, you know, what it achieved and the like. But well, yes, quite genuinely, I think it's, yeah, it's, yeah. I think I'm just going to repeat myself. It's hard to know exactly what it proved, but it's more that it got a lot more people thinking in a different way to the established science about how brains worked.
Now, so far you've done three wonders, and they all kind of relate to you as either a child or as a young person. Do you think that's the key to us, to know what we were like when we were young? And I'm obviously asking that in the context of you doing my teenage diary on Radio 4. So for people who haven't heard it, we're here where you interview people, but they've got to come along with a diary they actually wrote in their teenage years and prepared to have you read bits of it out loud or them read bits of it out loud, and they get analysed accordingly.
Yeah, it's, it started off as a comedy show, really. But what I found was that whenever I tried to crowbar in comedy questions and the like, it was always far less rewarding than just asking people how they actually felt about a lot of that stuff. And often funnier answers came as a result of that than trying to tee people up for jokes and the like. I think, look, we all know that you will never love as purely or wholly of heart than your first love. We all know that, you know, when people go to counselling or psychologists, almost the first thing they're asked is, you know, how did you grow up? What were your mum and dad like? Yeah. So, I've got two children and, you know, have watched various parenting documentaries and read various parenting books. And yeah, there seems to be a pretty widely held belief that essentially by the time you're seven, you've worked out who you're going to be. From there on in, you're working out how that person copes with the world.
So what's your next wonder? Should we go on to that? Number
four?
Yes,
my next wonder is just broadly the woods. I've found a deep
deep love of the woods, and I will be brutally honest and say that at this point in my life, where I'm not really sure what I'm doing or what I'm meant to be doing next, about four times a day, I do wonder whether or not I could just get a bell tent and a log burner and just go and live in the woods and let this whole thing just deal with itself and leave me out of it. There was a Japanese study done in a hospital about a thing called forest bathing. And it turns out that just by being in the woods, our stress levels go down, our blood pressure improves. It's like endless benefits. And this all really ties in to something I'm basically obsessed with, I realized, which is, do you know the thing about the human year? Have you heard this?
The human year? No. How does that work?
So if you took... you know, a fraction past midnight on the 1st of January, you know, in the morning on the 1st of January, and said that was when the first human being existed.
Yeah.
And then you said, you and me talking right now, that is midnight on December 31st. So the entire of humanity is mapped onto a year.
Yeah.
At what point did we stop being cavemen? So give me a place in the year.
I think I've seen and heard enough of these things to know that it's going to be something like, you know, December the 29th or quarter to midnight or something hideously close. So
yeah, it's December 31st at 6:30 p.m. So ultimately, you know, we evolved all of this understanding of how to be and how to function and how to get along with each other. And the machinery that we evolved to do that is the same machinery that we've got now. But we just don't live in a way that endorses any of the thoughts and feelings that that machine requires. So all of that feeling that teenagers have of, you know, am I accepted? Am I part of this or whatever? Wouldn't have been an issue before because you were part of a tribe. Of course you're part of something. Look, you're here, you're part of the tribe. Yeah. Your skills are endorsed. Your work is required, you know.
Yeah,
it's I do see that the vast majority of discontent that most people feel is a direct result of just absolutely not living as we should. Do you know the thing about the Victorian explorers who eventually talked to the native tribesmen, and the native tribesmen after a while said, so come on then, how do you do it? You're so interested in what we're doing here. How do you do it?
Yeah.
And these Victorians explained, oh, you know, well, we get married, and they were all just pissing themselves laughing, going, what, one woman? You're meant to keep one woman, like, and make her happy. All that, they were just killing themselves, you know, like, what, you all raise your own children, but what if they're being like crazy annoying or you've got other things to do?
Yeah,
it just made no sense to them at all. And when I read that report, I thought, that is it, isn't it?
Because
if you lived in close community where you all had each other's backs, somebody turning up and saying, oh no, this isn't how you do it, would just seem ridiculous.
Well, there's an author called Gerald Diamond who's written about this sort of thing. And one part of one of his book, he's wandering around a jungle rather than woods. And the kids know all the plants and the trees there because they need to know you can eat that root, but not that fruit. You can do this. And of course, he doesn't know those things. So he comes across as stupid in that circumstance. And none of us know because we know. Well, since agriculture came in, we just know how to grow wheat and oats and five other crops. And we know three or four animals in any area. And we forget about everything else. We don't need to. Everything else is weeds or pests. That's just the way. But so just tie a bit more back to woods. So do you live near any woods or is this just or do you go to them? Or is this just a dream that you would like, you know, an aspiration that you'd like to go to the woods?
Yeah, I think it's that when I'm in the woods, I feel like, yeah, this is where I should be. This is where humans really belong. And, you know, you can sit under a tree in the pouring rain, stay dry if it's the right tree. And I bought some ropes and a harness so I could, like, start climbing trees. And I've done some green woodwork and sat in the middle of the woods and made an actual functioning chair. And
it's
just all of that, the actual exposure and the really existing in nature is I don't know, it's so cliche that, you know, get outside, get into nature. But specifically, I think that from our simian ancestors through to, you know, our, you know, nomadic existence, especially as North Europeans, there is something about the smell of woodland, just the being in it, that immediately feels right.
Well, I'm very sympathetic to this view. I'm a big fan of woods myself. I'm actually president of the Woodland Trust, so I must get you to join in. But
I'm a member.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for that. I don't want to just pass over the fact you threw away a line there. I've nothing else to do, or I'm just going to go off in the woods. The last time I spoke to you, last time I interviewed you, you were busy on stage. You were doing, as it happens, The Good Life, which kind of fits a stage version of The Good Life, which is a sort of back to nature kind of quality to it. And I've mentioned lots of other plays and shows and things that you've been in. You give every impression of being, I mean, subject to COVID and all the other interruptions, a busy actor and performer. Are you just being that sort of natural, things could go very bad for us because acting's such a difficult task, isn't it, Johnny? Are you saying it is, times are hard?
Yeah, times are hard, man. I mean, you know, I built an entire career. I drove my career towards theatre because, hey, guess what, Clive? You know, even during the war, theatre didn't close, so this thing's bulletproof. Yeah. And, you know, it was the first thing to close. It's had a tricky journey reopening. There are things coming back, but people are still a bit anxious. You know, there's still a lot of money to lose doing those things. And, you know, the last couple of jobs I did ultimately weren't what they should have been. And as a result, I think I probably didn't do myself many favours with the producers on those shows. And I'd rather feel now like, as people are looking for folk to employ, I question whether my name's really top of that of many lists.
Well, it's a memorable name. Not only can you, not only you can do the job of doing these. I mean, you did. You took over from James Corden in
One Man.
One Man, Two Governors. So that's quite a challenging thing to do. And you co-starred with Robert Lindsay in the Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Again, those are both those are brave things you've got to be up there. You've got on your mettle for both of those, haven't you?
I mean, I don't know if you're going to leave this in this podcast, but I'm glad you've raised this, Clive, because twice you've interviewed me on Radio 4, and the first time, immediately beforehand, I shared with you an off-mic conversation about my experience working with Robert Lindsay, and I don't think I've bumped into you or talked to you since we haven't gone. And, of course, worked with the great Robert Lindsay.
So, I'm just drawn to the names you've worked with and the people you've taken over. Well, talk about James Corden, if you like, because, I mean, his career has gone on leaps and bounds, and he did other things before then, but as a sort of stage performance that, you know, he was, you know, really marked out there. And it's sometimes a thankless task to be the person who takes over from
God, I mean, it really was. And, you know, I didn't take over directly from him because the National Theatre rather assumed that at the point he left, the whole thing would fold. And yet people still kept coming, you know. So, he'd done it for as long as he'd done it. Then another guy took over in the West End for, I think, a year. Because they thought the show was going to close, they booked the tour immediately afterwards, but then the show kept selling in the West End. So then we had a tour further away from the West End, at the end of which that touring company went to Australia with the guy who'd been in the West End, and I went into the West End and joined the company that he'd been working with.
So there have been plenty of good times. I'm trying to cheer you up when you're saying you're going to go off and sit in the woods. Yeah, there's plenty of good work that you've had to do. And
I was very proud of my work on One Man, Two Governors. You know, there's a bit of improv and being alive in the moment.
Yeah, it's an acting role, but it's also a comedian's role as well, isn't it? Yeah,
that was it. When I saw James Corden do it, and I'm very impressed, as everybody was with him doing it. But I do remember watching it thinking, oh, God, they should give this part to somebody being a stand-up, you know, because somebody being a stand-up, you have to do all sorts of stuff with this. And James, as good as he is, he's not from stand-up, you know. Mm. So, but I hadn't imagined it would be me doing it. So, yeah, I was very proud of the work I did on that. However, it was 8 shows a week in a wool suit, running up and down, smacking yourself in the head, throwing yourself down, you know.
Yes.
Just breaking. Absolutely breaking. And because of the nature of the contracts that I'd been issued, it meant I was only allowed 3 days off over the entire year. And I think that was probably the point at which realizing the sort of person I am, that if I'm on it, I'm on it. Mm. I realized that was probably coming at the cost of things that other people might have prioritized more highly, like life and, you know, relationships.
Look, we're running out of time. We've only done, we've done four of your wonders. So we're going to have to do the others at a fair old lick.
No problem.
Christmas lights in poor places, I have done as your fifth one.
Yes.
I think I know what you mean, but why do you rate this as a wonder?
Having worked at the Science Museum and being an atheist and all of these things, I'm very given to, you know, don't lie about it. Just tell the truth. The facts, you know, the world is wonderful enough. As a result of which, all notions of magic and that just pass me by and leave me cold. Or at least did until 4 or 5 years ago when my son was at exactly that right age to be, you know, in love with Christmas. Mm. And at that point, I suddenly just saw everything in an incredibly different way. And it was that as mean as I think people can be and selfish as self-serving as people can be, if you walk down a residential street in, you know, in December, people have put out all these lights. Mm. Now, you know, Christmas is obviously adopted from a pagan festival. So it is this understanding that all throughout our human history, at its darkest, coldest and shortest and most miserable, as a gang, we decided to try and make it the most cheerful and happiest and most together and most loving. Mm. And I really do think that is magic. So, yeah, I wrote Christmas lights in poor places. You know, I could have said, I guess, economically disadvantaged places. Mm. But, you know, I gig all over the country and I've got, you know, mates across all socioeconomic groups. So I think sometimes on Twitter, people have thrown at me like, oh, yeah, all right for you, Johnny London millionaire. And I think, oh, yeah, I wish. Mm. You know, I'm all over the country. But specifically, if I'm somewhere really poor and I see Christmas lights, it can make me cry.
Yes.
Because I recognize that within that, it's not about money. It's not about what you've got. It's about choosing to take what little you have and turn that into joy and magic and hope and love.
And a slightly more superficial level, I know what you mean. There are places I go past in December that have got these things, and they year on year they sometimes get bigger and bigger. And yeah. Eventually, somebody's putting out. He could have Father Christmas. He could have a nativity scene or both. He can have angels. Yeah. He has stars. Yeah, yeah. There's lights, and it's just. And if you see it in you know, Regent Street or Oxford Street, well, it's sort of, oh, it's there to encourage shoppers, which is a different aspect of it. This is just for the joy of it. It's sometimes they collect, you know, money for charity by people coming to visit it. But usually it's just there. It's just what you do. You might be a little bit competitive with the guy over the road, but other than that, you're just doing it. But I suppose that, you know, that magic of people coming together at Yuletide, but also it's the simplest part of the Christian message as well is bound up in the nativity story, however fanciful the story is, it's a child being born.
You asked me about my teenage diary, and I've largely answered that question by saying everybody loves an origin story. You know, that's why that's why every Spider-Man movie, or you know, why they keep rebooting Spider-Man, and every Batman they reboot. It's like people love that origin story, and I guess we feel the same about the Christ.
Well, I hope I'm not doing your that wonder disservice by, so we've noted it.
No, that's fine.
You've explained it. Let's go on to number six, which I've got the advanced knowledge of what they are, but this is The Good Place, but it's the NBC sitcom. Now, not everybody is going to be familiar with the sitcom The Good Place.
No.
I can't pretend I've ever seen it. So why has this, of all the sitcoms or of all the other television programs and indeed anything else in the world other than the other six, why does this make it as your wonder of the world?
Mike Schur is a man who has been partly responsible for bringing The Office from the UK to America. I say bringing, I guess taking.
Acquiring it for,
Adapting for.
Yeah.
So they'd adapted The Office, and obviously that became this, I mean, you know, it's still revered now in America as being possibly in the top three sitcoms of all time.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Because The Office in this country was such a huge success. Sometimes you make it in another country, it's especially in America, it's not really, but The Office in America is in its own way a huger success in terms of quantity anyway.
Yes. Mm. Often those adaptations don't really work, but in the hands of Mike Schur and Greg Daniels, that adaptation did, to the point where they looked at making their own spin-off, which became Parks and Rec. Then they created Brooklyn Nine-Nine. At that point, they'd had all these hugely successful sitcoms, and NBC said to Mike Shore, okay, look, you bring us a project and we'll make it.
Yes.
And Mike Shore, because he's a just phenomenal human being, thought to himself, well, look, you know, if I do, hey, there's a family and the dad's a bit grumpy, like, what a wasted opportunity. If they're really going to kind of wave through anything on the grounds that they think I can pull it off, then I want to do something that nobody else would ever attempt to do. And so Mike Shore turned 500 years of ethical philosophy into a sitcom.
Yeah.
And how you, because that's already such a daft idea, that how would you then make it funny and not po-faced? How would you then actually care about the characters rather than just thinking, oh, these are all just at the service of the narrative? It's on every conceivable level of comedy, how comedy works, how comedy's performed, how comedy's edited, how comedy's written. And then the meta, all of that, is how, what can comedy be? Because comedy, when well utilized, can be just as affecting and just as effective as big, serious dramas, but people don't trust that it can.
So it's not set, so this is not set in a suburban street like The Good Life or dozens of other less good. No, but so I'm not sure you can answer this entirely because there's more to it.
No, don't even say that.
Where is it set?
Yes, quite so. So The Good Place is set in The Good Place, a version of heaven in which a woman called Eleanor Shellstrop, who has recently died, opens her eyes and is welcomed by the architect of The Good Place, who's played by Ted Danson.
Yes.
So it's Kristen Bell and Ted Danson. In the opening scene, he basically says, welcome to heaven.
Yeah.
Now, the secret is that Eleanor shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
So now you've got somebody who's in heaven who just doesn't deserve to be in heaven. And thus we open the door on the ethics of what makes a good person, what would leave all these people in heaven. And one of the most interesting things to me, the thing I would largely say to people to compel them to watch it, is that Mike Shore is also very good friends with the man that created Lost. And Lost was a TV show that people loved, but the longer it went on, the story just dribbled and dribbled and dribbled away.
Yeah.
So the man that created that, Damon Lindelof, said to when Mike Shore was talking to him, said, look, of course they want you to make more and more and more. You know, you want to keep everybody employed. You want to do that.
Yeah.
But I promise you, you want to tell your story in the time that you want to tell your story and just get out, leave it. All you're right. Done. And
they did that.
Well, Damon Lindelof then did that on a show called The Leftovers. And if you've never seen The Leftovers, oh my God, you have to watch The Leftovers. It's unlike anything you'll ever see in your life. It's so brilliant. So watch that. So yes, he'd nailed that with The Leftovers. But Mike Shore, knowing that, had this amazingly brilliant, wonderful, clever, thoughtful, moving, joyous, silly sitcom that was picking up steam and beginning to be a real award bait. And at its absolute peak, he said, yeah, you got 12 more episodes of this and then it's done. And when you watch those, that whole thing together, it is just perfection. It does every part of everything it does perfectly.
Well, you make a very good case for it. I mean, I understand a bit about it before coming to this conversation, but you make a very good advocate for the programme. And as you say, you've got those two and other high quality comedy actors, but set in a much more complicated universe than you normally get.
That's right. And you know, the art design, the jokes in the background, even the special effects, like honestly, every beat of it has been attended to. Even if you don't care at all about ethical philosophy, even if you're not thinking, oh, that sounds like something I'd like to watch, if you just want to watch something funny that isn't, you know, that isn't mindless,
yes,
then, you know, you should watch it just for those grounds, because it's certainly funny enough to stand on its own as a piece of comedy. But moreover, actually, if you can watch The Good Place and get to the last episode of it and not think that they wrote a thing that stands and belongs in the pantheon of writings about the human experience, the beauty of life, the necessity of death, well, you're a better man than I.
All right. Well, you've inspired me to want to go away and get a box set of the whole thing. Okay. We've come to your last wonder. So tell me, again, it's a who or what is your seventh wonder?
Yeah, I've chosen Ben Folds. The music of Ben Folds Five arrived on these shores, I think, in about 1995. Him and his compatriots had decided they wanted to be a rock band, but without the traditional setup of being guitar-led. So it was bass, drums, and then Ben Folds on piano doing all sorts of brutal and heavy rock and roll things on the piano. Mm. But just his musicianship, his ability, his ear, his tone, his sense of humour rang with me on his first single, Whatever and Ever Amen.
Yeah.
And honestly, from that single onwards, I've bought every album he's ever made, you know, seen him in concert a number of times. For my 40th birthday, I I was on a family holiday and my wife gave me permission. I found out that Ben Folds was playing a double-headed show with a band called Cake, who listeners may remember had a hit in this country with a song called The Distance. Mm-hmm. He was playing double-headed shows on a small tour with them, and my wife gave me permission to leave the south of France for 40 hours, fly to New York, watch these guys play a show, and then fly immediately back to the family holiday.
Well, I mean, that's an astonishing story in itself. I don't know if that reinforced your relationship or damaged your relationship with your wife, but obviously you must have been grateful at the time. Now, that's a long way to go and see. Couldn't you have waited for them playing a concert in England, which might have been happening somewhat, or at a time in America where you might be going there anyway, rather than interrupting a holiday in France?
Well, these double-headed shows where it was Ben Folds and Cake was only happening 12 shows. And I turned to my wife and went, oh, my God, that would... We'd actually weirdly had a conversation in the car the week before. We were playing a game of, like... What's the band that you never saw that you wish you could have seen?
Yeah.
You know, and it's come up with various answers. But I said to my wife at that point, actually, I think it might be Cake because they're kind of like lo-fi indie horns, kind of slightly sexy thrumming vibe. Yeah. I was like, I would have loved to have seen them. Yeah. And then literally a couple of weeks later, we're on holiday and it turned out they were playing a double-headed show with one of my favorite human beings alive. While I was on that holiday, by the way, I say holiday, while I was on that trip,
yes,
I saved a man's life.
Oh, wow. Well, tell us about that.
Well, I was staying with some friends of mine in New York that I'd only met on holiday 6 months previously.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So they'd said, you must come and visit us in New York sometime. And you turn up. That's already a...
horrifying.
Yes, horrifying for them.
Yeah, quite so. They're American. It turns out a lot of the time when those people say those sorts of things, they mean them.
Oh, you know, they meant it, not like the British way of saying, you must come and visit us. We must have lunch sometime.
Only ever means if you ever darken my doorstep again, you know, I curse you by the old gods and the new. So I stayed with them. Mm. Anyway, they, to welcome me to New York, took me on a right old night out. Oh, Clive, the fun we had.
Yes.
Finished the show. I only had a few hours till the plane left, so it was either I'm going to go to yours and, like, literally sleep and then get up and get on the plane, or we'll just try and fill all of this time. And because New York is the city that never sleeps, they were like, great, let's just go out. So we went out, and we had a few hours to kill, and we ended up back at theirs. One was a bit tired, the other not quite so much. So the tired guy went to bed. The other guy stayed up with me. And we, I mean, don't get me wrong, Clive, you know, we'd had a few sherbets. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But after a while, he really started like flagging, you know, like flagging. And he was sort of really slurring his words. And I'm thinking, there's no reason for him to be like this at all. But then he started snoring. He'd sort of fallen asleep. I found this all very funny.
Yeah.
But he was snoring in a way where it was like his throat was folded in on itself. I felt very uneasy about this. So I tipped his head back and the snoring stopped, but it immediately lolled forward again. Anyway, I'm enough of a lad, Clive, where I've been around people who've overindulged, and I didn't necessarily know what was going on, but what could I do? So I'm in these guys' house. I don't know where anything is. I looked round because they didn't have kids. They didn't have any kind of plastic things. It's all very jazzy, lovely things. So I found this designer porcelain bin. I put that between his legs. I got all the sofa cushions and flumped them round him to sort of put him in some kind of position because I wanted him to stay back. But his head kept rolling forward. And every time it did, he was going like that. So I found some gaffer tape and I gaffer taped his head up to the back of the sofa to like clear the airway, you know.
Mm.
So I did all of that. In the morning, his other half got up and said, "What the fuck happened here?" And I explained, and he rolled his eyes and went, "Oh, God, you know, I've been with this guy for years. He always, it's like, you know, this is just what happens. He's overdone it, you know, not to worry." So me and the other guy then leave the flat and go and get coffee. I get coffee. We have lovely. Thanks, lads, for having me here and the like. Very kind of you. I then go to the airport and send them a text and say, "Guys, really can't thank you enough. What a wonderful trip. Joy of joys." Don't hear anything back from them.
Mm.
Like a couple of days go past. I'm now back in France. Like, "Guys, you know, maybe the last message didn't get through or whatever. I just want to say rock and roll, New York, you know," nothing. At that point, man, my heart goes through my backside because I'm like, what did I do? What have I done? You know, like I put the gaffer tape on the sofa. There was no need for that. It was an overreaction. It was all too much. Well, it turned out... one of the guys I was staying with had his drink spiked with a drug called KBJ or KGB or something like that. And while we'd been out and he'd got back and it was, you know, suddenly a bit all over the gaff, when they'd gone to hospital, because it was that drug involved and it was a party drug, the police confiscated both of their phones.
Right.
But essentially, when the boyfriend got back to his boyfriend, and he was still there, you know, fast asleep, like tried to wake him up and he wouldn't wake up. So all of that snoring and whatever that I'd thought was, you know, really bad and therefore I needed to clear his airway. If I hadn't been there that night and they'd just gone out to that place and he'd have been spiked,
yeah,
then he'd have come back. His boyfriend would have gone, "Oh, yeah, you know, this is just what he gets like."
Yeah.
Where it was only my unknowing that made me literally gaffer tape him so he could breathe to a sofa.
Is that something we can learn from? If somebody's sort of lolling forward and snoring and snuffling and that we should get gaffer tape and gaffer tape the head up? Or I suppose you'd been better calling, well, 911 it would have been in America, I suppose. But
The thing was, you know, there was nothing about our situation that made me think it was a medical emergency. It was just we'd all been out, you know, we were all coming back and, you know, a couple of hours. I mean, by this point, it was like 7 o'clock in the morning or something, you know. So, yeah, a bit of a weird one. Not necessarily one I would leave in the podcast, to be honest.
Right. Well, no, it's an interesting story. We've run over a bit of time because when you say I saved somebody's life in New York on the back of going there in the middle of a holiday to see, you know, relatively, would it be fair to say, a relatively obscure act?
Fair enough.
So,
yeah.
But anyway, that certainly was, I found that an interesting story. That is the end of the seven wonders. Thank you for, you know, describing them. Now I have to choose the wonder of wonders from your list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful as you described it in the podcast. And I was going, when I saw your list, I thought, oh, I know, I'll go for the woods because that's an interest of mine, president of the Woodland Trust and so forth. But I think that's a bit too, that's too much of me just voting with my own preferences. So I think the one that you made such a great case for and great advocacy for was The Good Place, the sitcom. So I'll put that as your wonder of wonders. And it's slightly intriguing why should that wonder be in there? So that's the one I'm going to go for.
Fantastic. Well, I'm delighted. Honestly, I think I have been an evangelist for that show for some time. There is nobody who knows me who hasn't been bored rigid with how good that show is. So I'm delighted to now also form that place in the hearts and minds of your listening throng.
Well, I mean, I could easily have gone for Jim Henson, but he's better established in lots of people's minds as late Jim Henson. I'm just going to say this as well. If you enjoyed listening to My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform, site or provider you found us on. Thank you very much for listening.
Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.